Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome to another episode of Tech Done Different. My name is Ted Harrington. I'm your host, and with me today is our special guest, Christopher Elliott. Chris, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Now, Christopher, I'll let you introduce yourself and talk about your background a little bit more, but I'm going to start by bragging about you a little bit. We got introduced through a mutual friend that we have, another podcaster who's, you know, says that you're just an incredible guest. I totally agree with him. And one of the things that really was interesting to me about wanting to have you on the show is you've written all these books. You're an expert in multiple things, travel being one, but you've also written a book about identifying scams and what to do about that. And so maybe you could just briefly introduce to our audience who you are, your expertise, and kind of what you specialize in.
Okay. But I got to tell you, I haven't actually been a guest on your show, so you don't know how awesome I really am. I'm about
we'll
to show
out.
You how awesome I really am, though.
I like it. We got to prove it first.
I'll prove it. Okay. I'll prove it. I am a consumer advocate. And that is I have three titles: consumer advocate, journalist, and author. But my true calling in life is to help people. And so I founded a nonprofit organization, several actually. The latest one is Elliott Advocacy, which is an organization that basically helps people with their consumer problems. So if you have any problem at all, I do tend to specialize in travel, but travel technology is one of our big ones. Buying a car, anything like that. Appliances that blow up, we specialize in those too. We try to help. I have a team of volunteers. We help you for free. One of the things that we do is we put a lot of information online. So for example, if there's a company that likes to hide from its employees, big company, we will go out and find the names, numbers, email addresses of all the managers. So when you're on the phone with tech support and they say, we can't help you, this is our final answer, and you say, is there a manager that I can talk to? And they'll always say, no, there isn't. This is the final line of appeal. You can't go any higher. Well, we find that manager for you. So Apple, Google, we've got all the managers, their email addresses. And so we try to empower people to use that information to help self-advocate. But if that doesn't work, my team actually helps people. We facilitate the advocacy. And so I've built my entire career around helping people. What I do right now professionally, this is how I pay my bills, is I write about what I do. So I write a column for the Washington Post called The Navigator. It's a travel column. I write another column for USA Today every Monday. And then I also have two nationally syndicated columns. One is called Problem Solved, and the other one is called The Travel Troubleshooter. And then I also have a Substack newsletter called Elliott Confidential. That's Elliott with two L's and two T's, and two blogs. One of the blogs is just Elliott Advocacy, so that's where we put all our information up. And then chriselliotts.com too, which is just I know it's starting to get a little boring, all this stuff. When is this guy going to quit? Well, that's it, I promise you. chriselliotts.com, my personal website. I put all of the stories that I have in my newspapers up online too, so people can find them easily. And I love to help. So if any of your listeners or viewers have a consumer problem, that's what I'm here for. Contact me, please. Elliott.org/help is the place to use a form you can fill out. And I really do mean anyone who has a consumer problem. I will try. I'll do my best. I'll knock myself out trying to help you.
I love it. I mean, certainly you being on a podcast to share ideas, that is certainly a form of service and help. So appreciate you being here and all that you do. I mean, I don't know about anyone else who's listening, but I just started having like PTSD flashbacks as you were talking about, you know, when you talk to customer service and they're like, here's the bad answer and it's the wrong answer and it's the last. We've all been through that. So you're definitely addressing a need that that exists. So as I was hearing you describe that, it sort of started triggering a few ideas. And, you know, tell me if this is not an area that that you really focus much time on. But one of the challenges in the security industry, which, you know, many of our listeners here are from security or more broadly from technology. One of the real challenges is that when you're talking about security in solutions that consumers use, so if that's your internet connected thermostat or your consumer grade app that you're, you know, interacting with, whatever it is that you're interacting with, a lot of the security, approach is on the manufacturer, but it's ultimately the consumer whose information is stolen or whatever. And they don't really have like the budgets or the influence that maybe an enterprise might have to lean on their vendor to say, hey, you've got to invest in security before I'm going to use this. Like the individual person isn't going to call up, you know, whatever IoT device manufacturer and say, hey, I'm not going to buy this until you, you know, secure it. What should consumers do or what should they think about in terms of the security of their own devices when they don't have the leverage of a company to help them?
Oh, I like that question a lot. I mean, you're familiar with the sites that I publish and what you might not know is that we are constantly under attack. We have security issues coming out the wazoo. People are, you know, I don't think people are really, they read the headlines and they see that, you know, there are these security vulnerabilities and compromises, password compromises, and whatever else not's going on. And all they know is that they get these warnings on Google saying your password's been compromised. But they don't really spend it. I don't think it really has sunk in just how unsecure things really are. And one of the things that I do as a consumer advocate is that I am a relentless purveyor of this idea that you have to take security into your own hands if you want to truly be protected. You cannot rely on a vendor or on a on another company that you're maybe doing business with for security. And I think that that's like one of my main goals as a consumer advocate is promoting that personal responsibility. And I would love to get help, of course, but right now I think that there's kind of an out of sight, out of mind mentality, and it's not just among the consumers; it's also in the tech world. As long as no one is mentioning it, we're just going to pretend it doesn't exist. I see a lot of that too, and it's very frustrating.
So, what about companies who are making claims to consumers about security, but those claims are not easy to verify? So, let me give you an example, and we can sort of, you know, workshop through this, I guess. So, my doctor's office. This happened. I don't know, maybe a year ago. This really struck me. I noticed that. As I was sitting waiting for the doctor, there was this flyer on the wall. And the flyer said, use our app. And then it said three things. It said, our app is fast, it's easy, and it's secure. And what really struck me about that was I can verify if it's fast. And I can verify if it's easy. Now, maybe I should take myself out of it because I'm a security guy. So I technically could marshal resources to verify whether it's secure. But the average patient sitting in that room would not be able to verify whether it's secure. And these kinds of things happen all the time. Like every single day, companies claim, they make claims like highly secure, military grade encryption, bank level security. They're making these claims to, and I believe come from a good place, which is to help the consumers understand that, hey, we've thought about security and you don't have to worry about this problem. But then they don't back it up with anything. And as a security professional myself, that raises a lot of red flags where I'm like, they're just saying it, they're not actually doing it. So in your estimation, what should we do about that? And by we, I'm talking about, I guess there's two we's, you know, what should consumers do about that? And what should those of us in the security community who are advocating for doing security better, what should we be doing to change that situation for consumers?
Well, the answer to your first question is pay more attention to security. Even if you're just online and you see an HTTP versus HTTPS, most people don't have any idea what that extra S stands for. They just don't know. And so even a little bit of knowledge can help. What does it mean to have a secure app? What exactly does bank level security mean? I don't think people know. They don't know anything about encryption. There is a kind of a base level knowledge that I think as an informed consumer, you ought to have. And I think that's sorely lacking. And I base that on the conversations that I have with hundreds, thousands of consumers every month, is that they just have no idea. They know their password's been compromised, but how did it happen? What responsibility, if any, do I have in this? Could I have done something to make sure? And the answer is, you know, usually yes, you probably could have. Maybe you shouldn't have reused your same password over and over again. You know, in terms of the IT industry and security professionals, I do understand that people are making claims because they want people to know that they care, but also because it's good for business. And I think you have to almost separate those two. If you are going to make a claim like that, you should be prepared to back it up. So what does it actually mean? And you should be transparent about that. So if you're going to say military grade encryption, you need to tell them exactly what that means. And so often, as you know, your doctor's office, what exactly did your doctor say about security? He or she said it's just secure. Well, what exactly does that mean? I mean, was there a fine print? Was there a little asterisk that said, here's what we mean by more secure app? I don't know. You'll have to answer that question.
Sure. From a personal standpoint, you know, I am really glad to hear you say what you're saying, because it's echoes almost verbatim the kinds of things I talk about in my book, which one of the key arguments that I make in this book is that security is a competitive advantage for companies. You know, so if you're building that application that your doctors are going to use or whatever, you should be able to use security and in an authentic way make that claim that, hey, this is more secure than the competition, but you need to do it in a certain way. And so what you're talking about, I wrote down here a couple of the words that you said literally are in my book. You know, you got to back up your claims. You've got to be transparent. And so it's one thing if I say it. It's another thing if someone else says it, who is a consumer advocate, who's saying, hey, you know, this is exactly what companies should be doing in order to support your customers, is be true. Tell them what's actually happening. And that's what I'm hearing you say. So that's really great advice. And hopefully people who are listening will go to the marketing department. You know, I don't know how many marketers necessarily listen to this show, but they'll go to the marketing department and say, this is what we have to do, because I'm already investing my blood, sweat, and tears in securing this thing. Let's make sure our customers know it. Is there any sort of, I'm a believer in, you know, the carrot, the rewards more than the punishment, you know, the stick. But when it comes to companies that violate the consumer trust, what's the stick, right? What is the bad thing that happens for companies who do wrong by the consumer? And then, you know, I guess there's two parts. One is they fail the consumer in some way. And then after the failure, they do a poor job of actually making up for it. What's the downside or ramification for a company when that happens?
Well, I don't want to get too political here, but Okay. We're seeing that unfold right now with Parler. We're seeing a company that, on a very basic level, let its customers down. It allowed people to say whatever they want to. Some of it was irresponsible. And you see Amazon and Apple pulling the plug on Parler. That may be an extreme example, and this is not in my wheelhouse as a consumer advocate. I am not a political guy at all. But we've also seen companies that really do bad by their consumers. They jack up the prices. They don't take security seriously, and they do get punished. Sometimes it takes a while for people, you know, repeat violations for a large company, let's say a hotel or a resort that continues to have security breaches, for people to finally catch on. But, you know, one prominent example was Blockbuster Video, which just, went out. It became obsolete, but it also did some terrible things to consumers. It had ridiculous late fees. That's not an IT example, but it's an example of a company doing bad by its customers and then going out of business because it did some bad things to its customers.
That's really fascinating. And what I'm hearing you say is something along the lines of that consumers can kind of vote with their wallet, or maybe let me ask that as a question. I'll put words in your mouth. Are you saying that what consumers can do, what the punishment is that when consumers see a company behaving badly, they stop working with that company, stop paying, you know, whatever for that company. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, I am something of a free marketer in that I think that people can influence a company by, you know, voting with their wallet, but in some industries that doesn't work. The travel industry is a really good example. In airlines, we basically have an oligopoly with four big players, so you have no choice. But in technology, you have cable and wireless, and those are places that just don't have a lot of competition. And so going to a competitor is not really going to make that much of a difference, because you really, especially with cable, you don't have much of a choice or any choice at all. So it has to be a combination of consumer behavior and consumers saying, no, I'm not going to do business with you, and thoughtful, and I would emphasize and underscore the word thoughtful, government regulation. Because, you know, I don't want this thing to be completely overregulated, but the government does have a role to play when a company does something bad. It can't just be the free market. That doesn't always work, unfortunately, especially when you have monopolies or oligopolies.
Man, you just have totally helped shape what my thinking has been on the topic of regulation for a really long time. I haven't been able to like put a pin on it the way that you just did. This idea of thoughtful regulation, that's amazing, because people ask me that all the time. They said, you know, is the answer regulation? And so, for example, when it comes to internet connected devices, the Internet of Things, my answer for years was always no, because regulation is not an effective security measure. It takes too long, too much compromise is involved. And by the time it's enacted, the attackers have adapted. So it just doesn't even work. What's the point? But over the years, I noticed that the free market wasn't actually driving change. You know, the companies were having all these security breaches and embarrassing security vulnerabilities discovered, and nothing was happening to them. There was no downside. And so now the answer, I feel like I'm begrudgingly saying, okay, fine regulation, but the way you said it, thoughtful regulation, which is not saying regulation is the sledgehammer that's going to solve the problem, but, you know, being, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so maybe you can help me define a little bit better. But what I heard you say was along the lines of regulation that is well considered in the context of what's trying to be achieved. It's not the whole solution. Am I capturing what you were saying correctly?
I think you are, yeah. I mean, right now in the current regulatory environment, we have the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that's giving out $1 fines. It's a joke. It's really a joke. That's the extreme end under the current administration, which is not going to be around for very much longer. And then you have extreme, you know, European style regulation where every little thing is being regulated. What I'm saying is that the needle needs to be somewhere in the middle. You need to have, it needs to be a credible threat, because if the government can't fine or regulate or in some way affect change, then companies are just going to do whatever they want to. And you're going to have, and then consumers, if they can't vote with their wallets, which, as I said before, in some industries, it's difficult, if not impossible, to do, then, you know, you're left in a very, very bad place where consumers, and, you know, we had that situation with Comcast a couple of years ago where it was just doing whatever it wanted to because it could. And there have been some market shifts that have changed that, fortunately, and Comcast has come around. But for a while there, it was just doing whatever it wanted to because it could. And that was a very bad situation.
Yeah, I mean, not to dump on Comcast, but I think they still are doing whatever the heck they want. I had this experience with my parents where they live. So I'm fortunate that I live in a, you know, a city center where I have options of what I want to do for my internet. But my parents live in a more suburban area, and there's literally the only option to get internet is Comcast. And I was trying to help them cut the cord because they don't need to pay, you know, hundreds of dollars a month to get hundreds of cable channels and a phone line, all the stuff they don't need. It's like, we just want the internet and then we'll buy the streaming services. And the way that what Comcast puts you through to cancel your existing cable internet to get internet only, it's nearly impossible. So I'm actually going to be contacting your company on their behalf specifically to solve that problem, because they keep getting the, you know, user manager runaround. So it sounds like, sorry, I didn't mean to go down a rabbit hole on Comcast, but the point is, you know, as illustrating your point that companies can kind of do whatever they want if there's not an option.
No, it's okay. I mean, I just dealt with another company, a wireless company that transferred a customer who was just trying to cancel their service to the retention department. I mean, we could probably spend a whole hour talking about retention departments. They're there to say no to you. No, you can't leave. And they're, you know, giving you 100 reasons why you can't and trying to entice you into staying. And that's really bad customer services. A retention department, if it was really doing its job, would maybe offer you a way, an incentive to stay. But if you said no, then they would take no for an answer. Mm-hmm. And they would not throw up all these hurdles, surcharges and extras. If you're going to, you know, now you have to return our equipment and it's going to cost you extra. And you have to go down to the UPS office and put it in a box and everything. That's just so customer hostile. It's so against what these companies actually stand for. If you look at their charters, the business, the statements about their business that they make and their missions, it runs counter to what they're saying. They're just actually, you know, it's like Google says, don't be evil. And then it does something evil like that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. It's interesting, the idea too, what we're talking about right now, customer service and how to deal with, dissatisfied customers. And, you know, different companies approach that problem differently. And what's really absent from the scenario that you just described is the interest in improvement. For example, in our company, when we have the unfortunate, I have a security consulting company, and when we have the unfortunate case happen where a customer wants to leave, which we're lucky that it's not very common, but it, you know, like any business, it happens. When it happens, the first thing we, of course, are wanting to see, hey, what's wrong? Can we fix it to retain you? And if we can't, then okay, you know, no harm, no foul. Like, why would two organizations who don't want to work together keep working together? But what we're really trying to understand is, what was the breakdown? How can we get better? What can we do better tomorrow? And from what I'm hearing you say, it sounds like, you know, and when companies are doing it wrong, it's because they're not trying to understand the customer and try to improve their experience. Is that a correct read on the problem?
It's even worse than that, because companies don't really have a motive to do better. In fact, there was a study that was done recently and written up, I think, in Harvard Business Review about companies, I think it was specifically airlines, that said that had they tracked customer service and customer satisfaction and found that actually in some cases, the worse the customer service was, the more profitable the airline was. And so if you're, a bean counter or even an executive at one of these companies, you're saying, what exactly is the reason why I would provide good customer service? And if the answer is there is none, in fact, if you give bad customer service, you're going to be more profitable. In other words, you're not going to have to give more product back or refunds or have a large call center that you staff or whatever, then, maybe you're going to decide to put customer service on the back burner. I know you haven't done that, but I think maybe you know some people in your industry who have done that and just like, take it or leave it, whatever, we don't care. We're too big to fail, whatever. And that, I find that very frustrating as a consumer advocate, because they're one of the assumptions that I make is that everyone wants to give great customer service and that customers will reward great customer service with their business. But that's not necessarily true, unfortunately.
You brought up a really interesting disconnect with when companies have a mission that says one thing and then their actions are something else. And this is sort of what we've been talking about the past few minutes here. What's your take on why that condition exists and what should companies do about it? I mean, I guess there's how do they first understand it even exists in themselves? And then once they identify it, how do they change it?
Well, I mean, if you're running a medium to large size company in your space, and I mean, one of the first things that I would do is walk over to, if you have a customer service department, and start reading some of the feedback that you're getting from people. You may not even need to do that. If your email address is out there, you get feedback from your customers already. So you know, are people happy? Or are they not happy? And then compare it to what your mission statement is. If you're finding that people are saying, and this is, here's a real pro tip. If people are saying that you have gone against the very principles that you stand for in the emails to you, that's usually a pretty good sign that there's a disconnect. And that happens much more often than you would think.
Yeah, that's interesting. I would imagine that's probably because when someone wants to complain about something, they're looking for not just, hey, I'm unhappy, but trying to use the company's own words back against them to say, I'm unhappy and it's in conflict with what you told me I was going to get.
One of the strategies that I recommend as an advocate for self-advocacy is that if you see a company behaving in a way that it has publicly said it won't do, and I'll just go back to don't be evil because that's an easy one. If you see a company behaving evilly in an evil way, then mention that in your correspondence, your email with customer service and say, look, these are the values that you have held yourself to, and you're not living up to that. But say it in a really nice way. And sometimes that actually can help you in your case. If a company is not doing what it says it was going to do. And again, also one of the other strategies that I recommend is if a company tells you that it's going to do something and it doesn't do that, point that out too. But again, if you're not being true to your own values, that's going to definitely, you probably already know. You don't need to go and read the emails. You already know. The real question is, what are you going to do about it? I mean, chances are you know how much it costs to have a staff a call center. You know how much it would cost to give the really great customer service. And you've probably done the cost-benefit analysis. And so you know. You probably have said to yourself, you know, there's always going to be unhappy customers. It just happens. But really, what you haven't done is you haven't made the investment in the good customer service and to see what kind of fruit that bears out. You may find that by doing the right thing, your customers will reward you even more with their business and more referrals, which will translate into more business for you. So it's really an unknowable thing. Is giving better customer service good for my bottom line? As an advocate, of course, I would say, yes, it is. But you don't know until you've actually done it.
Right. Yeah, because sometimes that's the short-term cost is easy to measure. This is what it would cost to staff the call center and all the other things you identified. But the longer-term benefit is an estimation. It's forecasting, saying if we have good customer service, we'll get, you know, this retention rate, this growth rate, and in 10 years from now, we'll be this much bigger of a company. And that's very different from, I want to go spend $1 million on this customer service initiative.
Well, you know, and some CEOs make a gut level decision to do the right thing. And I've seen that too. And that's a beautiful thing when it happens. Because in the short term, sometimes they're going to lose money. Sometimes they're just going to, you know, they'll have an off quarter or an off year because they've invested in, a better call center or maybe they've upgraded their customer service commitment. And they're going to have some explaining to do to their shareholders or to their board. They're going to say, we didn't do as well this quarter as we did last quarter, but we're investing in a better company and this is going to have long-term dividends. And as the CEO, you know, you're the leader of the company. You have to be able to explain that. But doing the right thing, I don't think that anyone has ever been, I don't want to say ever, but it's very unusual that you are punished for doing the right thing. It does happen, but it's doing the right thing is just the right thing. You don't have to explain it to anyone.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful. And we all know what the right thing is, right? We're human beings. Maybe not all of us. I mean, there are people who are sociopaths and stuff like that, but most people inherently have a moral guidance that knows what the right thing is and what the wrong thing is, even if you don't want to do the right thing. Now, do you feel that, now I know your expertise is as a consumer, consumer advocate, so this might be beyond the scope of your expertise, but do you see parallels, or do you know if parallels exist between how to deliver great service to a consumer base versus a consumer base that is consumers, a customer base that is consumers versus a customer base that is businesses? Are they similar, the same thing? Or are they dramatically different?
Well, I've done some in my journalism practice. I've actually done some business to business writing and interviewing people about business to business transactions. And I think good customer service is good customer service, whether it's to a business or to a consumer, or even to your own employees. I mean, sometimes your employees are involved as they're your consumers as well. And the same basic principles apply of doing the right thing. Maybe, you know, not to get theological, but doing to others as you would want them to do unto you. And it's so easy to lose sight of that. I think that when, you know, the money starts to come in and people start acting very deferential to you because you're the CEO, it's very easy to think that the rules don't apply to you, mm-hmm. but they actually do. What goes up can come down. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and maybe they apply even more to, I would even argue, yeah, they apply yeah. more, because what the leadership does, and this, I guess, goes beyond the CEO, but the CEO and then, of course, the C-suite, those actions, behaviors, lines of thinking, that directly translates to everyone else in the company, because they're looking to leadership to say, how do I behave? Even if you're talking about well-experienced, seasoned people with well-grounded principles, within the context of the company, they're looking for guidance on how they should behave for the company. Would you agree with that?
I definitely agree with that. I think that the leadership is so important. That's not something we've really talked about yet, but without good leadership, you're going to be dealing with a rudderless ship and people who are just doing what they think might be the right thing. And that might be saving you money, because sometimes departments are entrusted with, are given a mission to save money wherever they can. And that can lead to some very short-sighted decisions too. So good leadership is really key.
So let's talk about leadership. What would you say, in your estimation, are a couple of the key principles that we should be looking for in what makes a leader good?
Yeah, I've had kind of a ground level opportunity to observe good leaders and bad leaders. And the good leaders are first and foremost really engaged. So they're the kinds of people who talk to their employees frequently. They don't sit in an ivory tower and issue edicts. And more importantly, they also talk to their customers a lot. And if you're spending a lot of time talking and engaging with customers and also talking to your employees, I think that's, at least from this consumer advocate's perspective, that's probably about 90% of the battle won right there, because you're hearing from the people who are the most important people to you. You're hearing from your employees and from your consumers. If you're not listening to them, then you're making decisions in a vacuum, and you're going to lose touch with basically everything that matters. So, I would say communication and being there for your consumers, for your customers and for your employees is really a big part of good leadership.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. And it's one of those things that in a leadership position, it sometimes feels difficult maybe to do that, because you say, oh, I've got all these initiatives and I got a vision and I got to, you know, do all these things. And I've seen different principles play out to execute exactly what you're talking about. And I'd be curious to hear if you have any stories or ideas of what you've seen work. But a couple that, even within my own company, there's two really different ones. My partner, the way he does it, my business partner, is he just walks around. So, I mean, it doesn't work right now when everyone's working from home, but when we're in an office setting, he literally just walks around, pops in people's office and we'll say, what are you working on? What's that on the whiteboard? And then, you know, 30 minutes later, they've had this incredibly productive conversation and he goes and, you know, that informs the thinking of what we're going to do. And then my approach is I call it lead through lunch. I don't know why I decided to attach such a ridiculous name to it, but the idea is every day I try to take somebody out to lunch and just say, hey, what's going on? What are you working on? What's happening right now? I should know about what challenges do you have? And those are two really different ways of executing what you're talking about. I'm curious if you have other ideas that you've seen people do in order to foster that communication.
I think that both of those are really awesome. I haven't worked in an office for almost 30 years. So I haven't actually seen a CEO interacting with consumers. What I have seen, though, is CEOs interacting with customers. So I said that wrong. I haven't seen them interact with employees, but I have seen them interact with customers. And I have, I think that the CEOs that are not afraid to pick up a phone and call a customer are on the right track. That's a good thing. But I've also seen CEOs answer emails directly and quickly. And that kind of responsiveness means so much. It means that, first of all, they're taking the time to read what their customers are saying, and that they're also taking that into account, hopefully, the next time they have a decision to make about pricing or customer service or anything like that. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I think, again, just being very responsive is so important. That does carry over, I'm sure, also to taking your employees out to lunch or kind of randomly asking them what they're doing. It's keeping those lines of communication open.
Yeah, that's really interesting too, what you just mentioned about responding to emails from customers directly. And I mean, you've seen that from titans of industry, like Elon Musk responds to emails people send him. I doubt he responds to as many as he probably gets. But I mean, you hear stuff like that, and it's that little thing makes a almost permanent impact on the sender of that email. And then anyone else who hears about it certainly has a really positive impact as well. So I'm totally with you on that. And responding quickly too, right? Just, it's not like the customer's right, yeah, having a problem. That's why they're emailing.
Well, you know, we publish Jeff Bezos' email address on our site, and people email him and they get emails back, which is great.
Yeah, that's incredible. You know, do you think in a case like that, that's actually Jeff responding, yeah, or do you think it's his team?
Oh no, it's really him. I'm fairly certain it's him. because sometimes I just don't have the time to send a very articulate response. So you'll get maybe a one line, but it's definitely it. No assistant would write that. It's definitely him.
Right, it just cuts to the
chase. He's legendary for doing that. Tim Cook is also pretty good about doing that. And there are a few standouts out there. Southwest Airlines, their CEO is also really good about responding directly to consumers. I've actually seen emails where they've all written back. And that's really inspiring to me, because there's so often there's this perception among consumers that no one is paying attention to anything. They're just a case number. And so to get those responses, it warms the heart.
Totally. Yeah, well, that I'm inspired hearing it, and I'm going to try that myself next time I run into some issues. So, well, Christopher, as we wrap up here, thank you for all the insight. This has been awesome. Let me ask you one last line of questioning to finish up here. What's next? What's coming down the line in terms of consumer advocacy? You know, how do you see companies changing? I mean, certainly the pandemic is shifting the way that companies even work. But in your worldview, what should the businesses and the leaders who are listening to this, what should they be thinking about in 2021 and beyond?
Well, we're in a really interesting place right now, because we're about to have a new administration in Washington, and we have a vaccine. People are getting vaccinated. I'm really excited about that J&J vaccine, one shot and you're done. I mean, that's going to change everything. So now we're looking at May and June, new administration, pandemic on the way out. looking back at what's happened to consumers during this time, how's their behavior changed? What's the new normal going to look like? No one really knows, but we have a pretty good idea that people, you know, they've been spending the last year behind their computers, stuck in their offices, their dens, wherever, at home. And I think that there is going to be emerging from this a new, much more informed kind of consumer with a different set of priorities as well. People are have a much more of a sense of what matters and what doesn't matter. I don't want to say they're less materialistic, but they certainly are thinking more about the things that matter to them. And I think that we don't really know what the answer is yet, but we do know that consumer behavior has changed so much during the pandemic. I imagine that as the pandemic goes away, we're going to see even more changes, and some of them are going to be permanent. Just we don't know what it's going to be yet. Only that the only certainty is that there will be more change ahead. And I think that that's a really exciting thing. There's a lot of opportunity there for your listeners and viewers as well. As you know, what are the changes going to bring for my business? I think it's all going to be good, actually.
I love it. That's such a good note to end on. The only certainty is change. I say that myself about pretty much everything. And it's good to hear someone who's constantly thinking about this echo that idea. So Christopher Elliott, you are the man. Thank you so much for spending some time here with us together today. I think you're going to have helped people really think differently about leadership, service, customer service, and many other things that we talked about today. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And for the rest of everyone listening, to learn more or to apply to be on the show yourself, visit tedharrington.com/podcast. We'll catch you next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.